Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 7th of August, these are our main stories. Niger's military rulers closed the country's airspace after a deadline from regional leaders threatening possible military action elapses. Rescue teams in Pakistan are trying to free people trapped in the wreckage after a train derailment which left dozens dead. A BBC investigation reveals shocking levels of mistreatment in a care home in Kenya.
Many have died of hunger here. They deny them lunch and dinner, all because they don't make time to come and feed them.
Also in this podcast, Donald Trump alleges he won't get a fair trial in a case of election fraud because of the judge who he claims is highly partisan. And girl power rules as Barbie makes $1 billion, ensuring Greta Gerwig becomes the first solo female director to pass that milestone. First to Niger, where the leaders of last month's coup say they've closed the country's airspace in response to the threat of military action against them. It comes after the passing of a 7-day deadline issued by the regional grouping ECOWAS, which had called on the coup leaders to restore the ousted president or face a possible intervention. Earlier, thousands of people gathered in the main stadium in Niamey, the capital of Niger, in support of the coup leaders. Our reporter Nkechi Ogbonna is monitoring the situation from Lagos in neighbouring Nigeria.
At the end of the ultimatum, we had expected a swift move of action or some mega announcement. But ECOWAS seems to be silent on what its next moves would be. So we're yet to hear from the bloc. But earlier today, pro-coup supporters in Niger gathered at the stadium in Niamey, the capital city, chanting anti-France slogans and cheering at the military junta leaders as they arrived the arena.
And do we know if that was spontaneous or if these people were bussed in and this was arranged?
No, we cannot confirm that. But we do know that the pro-supporters had been rallying in the last 3 days in support of the coup leaders who today emphasized that they were not backing down and they were not releasing power to ousted President Mohamed Bazoum, who is still held hostage at the presidential palace.
Within ECOWAS itself, there are varying views, aren't there, about how this crisis should be tackled?
Exactly. First off, Ghana has said it supports the move to restore democracy in Niger, but it did not explicitly say if that move would include the military option. Ivory Coast and Senegal have said they would support a military move if the need arises. But Mali and Burkina Faso, which are also currently led by military officers who overtook democracy and forcefully ousted their respective presidents, have joined forces with Niger to say any military intervention on Niger will be met force with force. But some of Nigeria's lawmakers have said a military intervention in Niger would be detrimental, especially because of the border states that Nigeria has with Niger, housing a lot of displaced persons, refugees, and some of them are actually living in Niger owing to decade-long Islamist and jihadist movements in that part of the country.
Nkechi Ogbonna. Well, the BBC's Krupa Paddy managed to get through to a resident in Niger's capital, Niamey.
People in Niamey, they're not feeling good. They are very anxious. The situation is difficult. In the past week, since the ECOWAS put the embargo on our country, all the effort made over the last decade will be destroyed by the school. The price of everything is going up, and the population cannot afford it. People are not able to share their opinion freely. If they do, they get arrested. So they don't speak up because of fear.
When you are at home and you turn on the TV or you turn on the radio locally, what do you hear and what do you see?
The reporter, they must report the military. Nobody can speak freely. People can't speak freely. On the radio or television, they are forcing journalists and the reporter to support them. That's what it is.
And are people going about their day-to-day lives as normal? I know you said that there is a fear
speak. Yeah, people are going to go to job as normal. But what you cannot do, you cannot freely give your opinion. That's what it is. If you don't support the military, you need to stay home or to hide somewhere.
What do you think will happen in the coming weeks? Or what's your biggest fear?
I don't see any sign for them to back down. And, you know, our country cannot support the ECOWAS embargo. So that means if they don't back down, the ECOWAS don't have no choice but to intervene militarily. You cannot protest against the coup. They're going to shut you down if you do. Because remember, the first time people did that, the first day of the putsch, they shot people.
A resident in Niger's capital, Niamey, speaking to Krupa Paddy. In southern Pakistan, an operation is underway to rescue people still trapped in a railway carriage from an express train that was derailed some 250 kilometres north of Karachi. At least 30 people died and dozens more were injured when the Hazara Express crashed. Around 1,000 people were on board the train. This man was taken to hospital after being injured in the crash.
It was so sudden, and we were sitting comfortably until then. We heard growling sounds, and I gathered that the train had derailed. Then a storm of dust spread. Then a berth fell on my head, and there was blood.
Taru Bhaskar from the BBC Urdu service in Lahore told me more.
Approximately 10 compartments of the train derailed, and there were a total of 19. So there's a huge number that got stuck in this incident. Rescue teams are also struggling because it's a remote area. According to officials, they have somehow cleared 90% of the compartments, but they're still working on one compartment that is actually badly damaged, and people are still stuck in that compartment. Officials actually asked nearby districts to send heavy machinery so that they can cut those heavy metal sheets off those compartments to take out people who are stuck inside.
Has it become clear why this express train derailed? Do we know yet what happened?
Initially, the officials actually said that there might be two possibilities. One is that there can be a technical or mechanical issue. And the other one is there might be some foreign hand that actually deliberately tried to create this incident. But now they're saying that it looks like that there is a technical and mechanical fault.
And what do we know about the Hazara Express?
Well, this is a train that takes passengers from Karachi, that is in Sindh province of Pakistan, towards Punjab, that travels on daily basis. And there have been questions raised by a lot of people and authorities as well about infrastructure of Pakistan Railways, because these tracks are approximately 150 years old. They don't have that capacity through which, you know, high-speed trains can move on with excessive weight.
Taru Bhaskar. A BBC investigation into the care of the elderly in Kenya has uncovered the mistreatment and neglect of vulnerable residents at a care home near the country's capital, Nairobi. The World Health Organization says life expectancy across Africa has increased by almost 10 years in the last two decades, and Kenyans, like many others across the continent, often now look for outside help. But even with Kenyan government standards and guidelines governing care homes, there's a growing fear that in some cases the last thing that elderly people are receiving is care. And Jerry Mwanga reports.
The number of elderly residents in Kenyan care homes is increasing. But what kind of care are they really receiving? BBC Africa Eye began to hear worrying stories about abuse of elderly residents at one home just outside Nairobi, the Thogoto Care Home for the Aged. Local media filmed here in 2020.
I had no granny so close to me because my dad was an orphan.
This is the manager, Jane Gaturu, presenting an image of a safe haven.
Every old person is your shosho, is your granny.
This facility, which is home to around 50 residents, was set up by the Women's Guild of the local branch of the Presbyterian Church of East Africa, but is managed independently. During our investigation, staff admit to abuse at the home.
We beat him, and that's what calms him down.
And our undercover footage shows one resident being hit with a stick after she's found wandering outside the home's perimeter fence.
Hit her on the buttocks.
Our reporters found more evidence of neglect. Here, another man suffering from hand tremors explains that no one is helping him to eat.
If I don't get some help, I will sleep hungry. What can I do?
One staff member alleges that this lack of support has had deadly consequences.
Many have died of hunger here. They deny them lunch and dinner, all because they don't make time to come and feed them.
We also found evidence of medical conditions being left untreated. In secretly filmed footage, an elderly man, who we are calling Mwangi, is showing our undercover journalist parts of his body affected by a serious skin condition.
I'm feeling pain. Too much. Too much. I'm feeling like I'm burning.
Despite his pain, Mwangi says he is not getting the care he needs. And after 2 weeks without treatment, he tells our reporter that he is still in pain.
It is so painful, especially when I bend like this.
You really need to go to hospital. When you talk to Jane about it, what does she say?
She keeps promising that there are people coming, but they never come.
We put the allegations to the manager of the home, Jane Gaturu. She told us the home always observes the rule of law and does not condone any form of brutality towards its residents. Those who struggle to eat are given priority assistance, and any allegations that medical attention is not provided are lies and malice. We also showed some of our secret filming to Joseph Motari, the Kenya government's principal secretary responsible for social protection.
Are you aware of homes that abuse elderly people?
We are going to do spot checks on various private homes and see as to whether they meet the standards that they should be having.
Over a month after we first spoke to him, Mwangi, the man with the skin condition, did get treated in hospital with help from his family. Some of the stories we had were shocking, and whilst good care facilities do exist in Kenya, are there many other elderly people suffering silently in homes where there is neither care nor love?
And you can find the film Betrayed, Elderly Care Exposed on the BBC Africa YouTube channel. The former US President Donald Trump is making his feelings clear about officials involved in his case concerning election fraud. On his social media platform, Truth Social, Donald Trump says he'll be petitioning the judge to step aside, alleging he won't get a fair trial if she presides in the case. He also attacked the lead prosecutor and the Department of Justice, which he described as highly partisan and very corrupt. On Saturday, prosecutors in Washington asked a judge to issue an order which would limit what Mr. Trump can publicly discuss about his election fraud case, including on his own social media platform. More details from North America correspondent Sean Dilley.
I mean, it's quite extraordinary. We paraphrase slightly when we say he said he'll be petitioning, because that sounds far more respectful than the actual social media posts he's put out. He says that there's no way he can get a fair trial unless this judge recuses herself. Now, he says that they'll be arguing this on what he describes as powerful grounds. The problem is, for any defendant, is that broadly judges and courts like legal arguments to be made in the court of law, not the court of public opinion. But in reality, Donald Trump is very much playing in that arena, because, again, a point that his own lawyers have made here is part of the issue, and you have to concede there is a point in this. The part of the issue of the timing is that it's in the middle of political season while he's campaigning to run for president of the United States. It's a very nuanced thing. It's certainly not likely to go down too well with Judge Chutkin.
Sean Dilley. Staying in the United States, the actors' strike is entering its fourth week, and some of the biggest film stars, including George Clooney and Meryl Streep, have donated $1 million each to support their out-of-work colleagues. It's a reminder that while many of the performers in Hollywood are rich and famous, the majority of SAG, the Screen Actors Guild members, earn modest wages for small, supporting or walk-on roles. Tom Brooke reports from New York.
Say it loud! Say it strong!
Among those striking actors on picket lines in New York in recent days was 29-year-old Melissa Ricciero. She's been a working actor for the past 6 years. She's had jobs in commercials, television and film. She's one of America's 160,000 unionized actors currently on strike. The issue vexing her the most is how her real income has declined because of streaming.
A few years ago, I had one line on an episode of FBI that runs on CBS.
Ma'am, you requested the personnel file on Dan Osborne.
Every time that would air, I would get a check. You could make a decent living. I think I made $10,000, $15,000 off one line, right, which is not bad. The same exact episode on Netflix. In fact, I was in two episodes of a show on Netflix. I probably made $700 in residuals.
Instead of working, Melissa nowadays has a new routine, leaving her home and walking to her local subway station. This week, she traveled downtown to join a picket line outside Netflix offices in New York. A big concern of Melissa's striking colleagues is the use of AI, artificial intelligence, in movie making.
Background actors are a great example of this. What they want to do is they want to pay background actors a day rate, which is $180, scan them, and then use their likeness in perpetuity for the rest of time. We can't let that happen.
But the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which is negotiating on behalf of the major studios and streaming companies, says this claim is incorrect, stating their AI proposal would only permit digital replicas of a background actor in the film the actor is making, not for eternity. Overall, the studios have not endeared themselves to the strikers, particularly early on when Bob Iger, chief executive officer of Disney, appeared on the business news channel CNBC, taking a firm view on the actors' demands.
There's a level of expectation that they have that is just not realistic. And they are adding to a set of challenges that this business is already facing. It is and has been a great business for all of these people.
Many of the stars who've appeared at union events are not short of money. Their presence, while welcomed, can confuse the message that the vast majority of strikers are not economically privileged. Melissa Ricciero again.
90% of us out here are not out here making millions of dollars a year. We're just out here trying to pay our rent and make our health insurance, and all we want to do is be paid fairly.
The strike is just one aspect of a growing crisis enveloping Hollywood. Film critic Stephen Garrett.
The problem with the streaming sites is that there's so much content on there now, which means there are tons of television shows that nobody's watched. And that's a conundrum, too, because I think the studios can really wait this out a lot longer than the actors and the writers might think.
The dispute is also taking place at a time when traditional television, long a stable revenue source for Hollywood, is declining with fewer homes paying for cable or satellite TV. This, on top of the reduced box office and cinema admissions, means there is great uncertainty over revenue streams in the industry, reducing the willingness of the studios to accommodate to the demands of the strikers and making the dispute that much harder to resolve.
Tom Brooke. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
Hi, Anna. You and your mother are going to space.
Anna, we won!
Over the moon, the mother and daughter who won a competition to travel into space. Pope Francis has held an open-air mass in front of large crowds in Portugal at the end of a week-long international festival for young Catholics. The ceremony took place in the capital, Lisbon, where the Pope also led a vigil with more than 1 million pilgrims. Alison Roberts was at the mass on Sunday and sent us this report.
Son mucho lo conflicto. Pensando en este continente, siento un gran dolor.
Celebrating Mass with over 1 million people this morning, the Pope highlighted the suffering of the people of Ukraine in calling for peace in the world. But in his send-off to the vast crowds of young pilgrims, he offered above all messages with a personal focus, such as that they must not be afraid to act, to question, and to engage with the world away from social media. Throughout his stay in Lisbon, he hailed the spirit and restlessness of young people, casting them as a means of bringing about change in a church that he has said needs it badly. One of the phrases he used most often here was that the church is open to all without exception.
Alison Roberts. Sunday was another day of upset at the Football Women's World Cup. The defending champions, the USA, were knocked out, defeated by Sweden 5-4 on penalties. Shama Khalil was watching the game in Melbourne.
The reigning champions, who are going for a record third World Cup, are now out of the World Cup. This is a team that has dominated the game internationally for years. It has produced legends, some of whom were playing today on the pitch. Today, they were their fearsome selves. They played aggressively, they pressed, but they just could not score goals. Sweden's defense and their goalkeeper, who hands down was the woman of the match, just would not allow them to score. And then it came down to penalties. And what a penalty shootout that was. Sweden won by the narrowest of margins in the end. Megan Rapinoe, who says goodbye to world football, missed a penalty. And what a note to go out on. It definitely hurts. There are going to be many questions about their performance in this tournament, about why they didn't gel. This tournament has been described as the World Cup of surprises, of firsts, of unpredictability. And I think for the US fans, this has ended with the worst of surprises for them.
And here is the star US player, Megan Rapinoe.
You know, I felt like we controlled the game, but that doesn't win games. And at the end of the day, you got to put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah.
It's a tough one, and there's just some dark, dark comedy in me missing a penalty in my last game ever.
Megan Rapinoe. In the other game, the Netherlands went through to the last eight after beating South Africa 2-0. On Tuesday, the reggae girls from Jamaica will take on Colombia after drawing their last match with Brazil to get through to the second round for the first time ever in the competition. Some have hailed it as the proudest moment in Jamaica's football history. Olivia Grange is Jamaica's Minister of Culture, Gender, Entertainment and Sport.
There are those who shed a tear because it's a dream come true. It's a goal that was set by the girls, that Jamaicans share that dream. And for a little country like ours with less than 3 million population, and you can barely see us on the map, and see that we were able to hold France to a nil all draw, and also Brazil, and we beat Panama. It, for me and for the people of Jamaica, we just feel like we have done an awesome job.
Olivia Grange. Well, Sidella Marley is an ambassador for the reggae girls and the daughter of the Jamaican music legend Bob Marley, as well as the mother of reggae singer Skip Marley. Back in 2014, after learning the team had disbanded because they weren't receiving funding from Jamaica's Football Federation, Sidella became a benefactor and was instrumental in ensuring they could take part in the last World Cup in 2019. Paul Henley asked her how it felt to see the team play so well at the competition in Australia and New Zealand.
It feels good. I think the girls put in the work that was needed. They were very focused. I would like to say they're always in warrior mode. And despite everything else that's been going on behind the scenes, they knew what they had to do. And they went out there and they did it.
There was a time, wasn't there, when the Football Federation in Jamaica refused to fund the women's team?
Yeah, it was disbanded, I think, in 2008. But in 2014, my son brought home a flyer. And that's how I was aware that Jamaica actually had a women's program. I made some calls to the Federation in Jamaica. And by the time, you know, I turned around, you know, I was being asked by Captain Burrell to be the global ambassador. And I still am.
And how important do you think your father, Bob Marley's passion for football was for you?
That is something that was instilled in us from a long time. It's like you wake up, you eat breakfast, you go to school. After school, you play football, you do your homework, you go to bed. But that was for my brothers. You know, my job was just to watch it happen. I think when Daddy said football is freedom, that saying to me now means so much more, just because I've seen not only my country, but other countries struggle for resources to get to this world platform. And so football is freedom is a real thing. And we're seeing it happen with the type of teams that are going through in this World Cup. There are a lot of upsetters in this World Cup. And I'm really just watching it with different eyes.
Will it be huge in Jamaica from now on, the sport?
Football has always been the biggest sport in Jamaica, just not the women's side of it. But now the women have put Jamaica on the map. So hopefully we will see local support increase. But if not, world support has increased, and that we are grateful for.
Sedela Marley. It is 6 months since a huge earthquake hit Turkey and Syria, killing more than 50,000 people and leaving many more homeless. But despite the tragedy, there are stories of hope, such as baby Afra, who was born beneath the rubble of her collapsed home. The BBC's Hanan Razek caught up with Afra and her extended family to find out how they are all coping 6 months on.
It was a moment that went viral around the world. Shaky phone footage of a man running from the rubble of a collapsed building, clutching a tiny newborn baby. A sign of hope amongst the devastation caused by the earthquake that hit Syria and Turkey in February this year. Baby Afra was born beneath the wreckage of her family's home in the Syrian town of Jinderes. Her mother died shortly after giving birth. The building collapse also killed her father and her four siblings. But now Afra has a new life. Adopted by Khalil Al-Sawadi, her uncle and the man who pulled her from the rubble.
I started to dig with my hands in the rubble. Then I could hear a voice. So I carried on and thank God Afra came up in my hands. She was still attached to her mother by her umbilical cord when I found her.
After the video of Afra's rescue went viral, the attention was intense and offers to adopt her flooded in from around the world. Khalil says the family struggled to convince authorities to let them look after her.
With the help from the police, we managed to get extra security to protect her. The doctors at the hospital didn't seem to believe that I was her relative. I felt that he didn't want to give her to me.
After a DNA test proved Afra is related to Khalil's wife, they were able to live with her. Since then, the family has turned down offers to live abroad in the UK and the United Arab Emirates. Khalil's home was destroyed in the earthquake. So for 2 months following the disaster, he lived along with Afra, his wife, and their seven children in a tent at a camp set up for people made homeless by the earthquake. Thanks to help from well-wishers, they have now been able to rent a house. But the family says it's very expensive, and they don't know how much longer they will be able to afford to stay. The road ahead might be difficult, but Khalil says the family are grateful for the chance for a new start following the disaster.
I lost everything. It was like going back to square one. I can't even afford sending my kids to school. But there are people living in worse conditions in Jinderes.
Khalil Al-Sawadi ending that report by Hanan Razak. Anna Mayers is set to make history this week along with her mum Keisha by becoming the first ever mother and daughter in space. The pair from Antigua won the tickets in a competition for a trip on Virgin's VSS Unity spacecraft. Louise Hosey takes up the story.
Welcome to space.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime adventure few of us will ever experience. But for Keisha and Anna,
fire.
Their dream is on the edge of becoming a reality. They're about to become the first ever mum and daughter in space. They'll be on board Virgin Galactic's VSS Unity spacecraft. Keisha says she still can't quite believe it.
To just have the experience to actually go to space and look at our amazing planet from that high and to just breathe that in and to just be in that energy is just super amazing.
Anna says the nerves are starting to kick in, but she's excited.
It brings out a lot of emotion in me because it's something that I've wanted for so long and it's happening. I know that we'll get to experience weightlessness and be able to see the planet from outer space. I have no words to describe how I feel about experiencing that.
Originally from Antigua in the Caribbean, Anna is currently studying physics at Aberdeen University and hopes to eventually work for NASA. Sir Richard Branson delivered the good news himself.
Hi, Anna. You and your mother are going to space.
Anna, we won!
Her mum won the seats on the rocket after entering a competition she saw advertised on a flight as they travelled to get Anna's student visa. Anna believes it was written in the stars.
Had I not chosen Aberdeen University and had we not had to take a massive detour to get my visa, we wouldn't be going to space.
This is cool!
Anna hopes her example will inspire aspiring astronauts, like some of these young people at a recent UK Space Agency event in Aberdeen.
I think that's really cool that people like from Aberdeen can go off into space. It's like really like amazing.
How does it make you feel seeing the rockets and everything?
It's great. It's because I see the Earth really well. And I can see my house from the Earth.
Anna and Keisha say their bond makes the voyage all the more special.
You're going to be the first mother and daughter to ever go into space. How does that feel?
It is so much more reassuring and so connecting to be able to do this with someone I love so much.
The Virgin spaceflight takes off from New Mexico on Thursday.
Louise Hosey. And finally, Barbie was one of the most anticipated films of the year, and now it's record-breaking. This weekend, it will have made $1 billion in ticket sales, meaning that Greta Gerwig has become the first woman to reach the milestone as a solo director. This report from Charlotte Gallagher.
Hey, Barbie. Can I come to your house tonight?
Sure. I don't have anything big planned, just a giant blowout party with all the Barbies and planned choreography and a bespoke song. You should stop by.
So cool.
Barbie's perfectly pink world, her dream house, and of course Ken, have seen millions of us flocking to the cinema. The blonde, beautiful doll that many spent their childhoods playing with has been brought to life by Margot Robbie, with Ryan Gosling as Barbie's permatanned on-off boyfriend, who's always in her shadow. Its distributor, Warner Brothers, says the film will finish the weekend with more than $1 billion in ticket sales at the global box office, just 17 days after it was released. The company says it proves movies are back after the cinema industry suffered as a result of the pandemic and competition from streamers. Greta Gerwig is also celebrating, becoming the first woman to hit the $1 billion mark as a solo director. The marketing campaign for the film has been huge, with hot pink billboards, a real-life Barbie dream house appearing in California, and Margot Robbie arriving at global premieres dressed in some of Barbie's classic outfits. Siobhan Sunnett is a film journalist and says the promotion added to the excitement.
This was an event movie, and I think we'll be seeing more of those sort of things. You dress up for it, you bring your friends, you wear pink if it's a Barbie movie. That really caught on with audiences.
Mattel, the makers of Barbie, are hoping to repeat the success with other toys. Barney the Purple Dinosaur, Hot Wheels and Polly Pocket are set to feature in upcoming Hollywood films. And many are betting on a Barbie sequel.
Come on, Barbie, let's go party.
I'm a Barbie girl.
Barbie in the pink. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Gabriel O'Regan and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as always, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time. Bye-bye.